It's not great right now, this economy, we know that. How not great, though? History can tell us. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, 20 August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So here is a way to frame things in this economy right now. See if this works for you. Things are getting better, but they are getting better more slowly. And part of that more slowly thing is that sometimes you actually go backward. The number of people who made first-time claims for unemployment benefits is back over 1 million for last week. We got that number this morning. It's not a huge jump from the report we got last Thursday, but definitely going the wrong way. Also going the wrong way, the number of job postings in some big sectors of this economy. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra gets us going.
Job listings are down by about 20% compared to this time last year, according to the job site Indeed.com. Nick Bunker at Indeed says they were down by even more in April and May, but now the rebound that had started has basically come to a halt.
Which suggests the possibility of a quick V-shaped recovery for the labor market continues to diminish. It's increasingly looking like we're in for a long haul when it comes to this recovery.
Job postings have fallen dramatically in industries that you'd expect, like hospitality and tourism, but also in banking and finance and software development.
We're at a stage now where we're seeing a pretty broad hit to posting that's not just in those sectors of the economy that are directly affected by the coronavirus.
And these numbers give us a sense of how a lot of employers are thinking right now. Daniel Zhao is a senior economist at Glassdoor, which also tracks job listings.
Businesses are less confident about their ability to return to economic normal, and thus they aren't hiring as much because they're concerned about their ability to keep those people employed in the long term.
And that tells us what to expect from future unemployment numbers, because it's hard to find a job when you can't find a company that's hiring. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
You can think of a couple of consumer behavior indicators that give you some good insights into how long this economy is going to be stuck, assuming the virus stays in charge, as it is. Airline travel is one, right? How do people feel about getting on a plane? Restaurants? I'm not sure that's a good one. There's that whole outside thing that a lot of people are okay with. How about movie theaters? That work for you? AMC and Regal and some other big chains are opening up this week, throwing themselves on the mercy of the movie going public. Marketplace's Jasmine Garz reports.
Pretty soon, Shannon Faye Gallegos will boldly go where almost no man has gone for the last 5 months or so, the movie theater. She lives in Texas, and now that theaters are reopening, she's ready.
I have to live, so I need to see what's going to be in the theater, and I want a big bucket of popcorn.
Movie theaters have been hard hit by the pandemic. Last quarter, AMC reported an over $500 million loss. Now those big chains are hoping there's more people out there like Gallegos, but that doesn't solve the other big issue, what to show. Professor Arun Sharma studies marketing at the University of Miami.
If you look at the long term, we will not have content coming out soon because content is completely closed down. So we will suddenly have this imbalance of having theaters but no content.
Many theaters will be showing older titles. The new Russell Crowe movie Unhinged is widely considered a test case for the reopening. And in September, there's Tenet, a much-awaited sci-fi thriller which the industry is pinning its hopes on. Paul Jargarabedian is with Comscore, a media analytics company. He says what cinemas are showing will only be part of the appeal.
It's going to be more about, are there protocols for safety and health in place?
And some think,
in this time, it just seems like an unnecessary risk.
Brianna Stimson in New Jersey says watching a movie is one of the easiest things to recreate at home.
It's not a bar. It's not a concert. It's just sitting there and watching a movie.
Like many, she's ready to dip her hand in a popcorn bag, but in the safety of her home. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Wall Street today? Yeah, more up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Back near the beginning of this thing, In March, we got a group of people together who study economic history.
My name is Kathleen Day.
My name is Carola Friedman.
My name is Eric Hilt.
You remember them, right? Kathleen Day teaches at Johns Hopkins. Carola Friedman is at Northwestern. Eric Hilt is at Wellesley. And we'd asked them back then what we ought to be keeping an eye on if we were going to understand just how bad this economic crisis was going to get.
Unemployment, of course.
Unemployment claims.
The unemployment rate.
Credit delinquencies.
Credit markets.
Credit for small businesses.
And bankruptcies.
We've gone back to them a couple of times over these past couple of months.
Honestly, I feel like I've done nothing but the dishes over the past 8 weeks.
So that they could take us back in economic history to help us understand the economic present.
There has been a lesson learned from the Great Depression.
The reason that the Great Depression was the Great Depression was that the financial system essentially melted down. And for the most part, the Fed did very little to try to stop that.
Banks by the hundreds, by the thousands are forced to close.
This time, it's obviously not man-made. It's a virus.
I think it's worse than I expected.
Could it be as bad as the Great Depression? It could be.
I'm optimistic that it won't.
I think it's going to be a very bad crisis in relative terms.
So here we are, almost 6 months after this crisis began. Let's turn the recorders back on.
Going.
Okay, and you want me to hold this close by?
New recording. All right.
Okay.
Okay, first, a summer progress report.
I have not learned how to make bread from scratch.
We drove to Grandma's house. That's helped a little bit.
My husband and my teenage son and I all love science fiction, so we're just pretending we're on a spaceship. And this is so when my son has to check in for classes, he's just contacting Earth.
Down here on Earth, though, how's the economy doing?
I'm growing increasingly pessimistic.
I'm not feeling good about it at all.
Not that much has changed since the last time we talked 2 months ago. It's still a big question mark and a lot of uncertainty.
But even in uncertain times, there are some markers we can use to keep track of what's going on. And let's start with the ones we mentioned right up on top.
Well, although financial markets are doing relatively well, the unemployment rate is still elevated.
Unemployment is bad.
The unemployment rate has come down just a little bit.
But it's still very dire.
10.2%.
10.2.
So that's still above the worst levels that were reached in the last recession.
And the longer this lasts, the more permanent unemployment will be for some, and the harder it's going to be to resolve this.
A growing share of the losses that have been experienced are becoming permanent.
There were 16 million people unemployed in this economy last month. That's according to the most recent report from the Department of Labor. And for nearly 3 million of those people, their jobs have gone away forever. Also,
bankruptcies are up.
When we first talked to our panelists back in March, there hadn't been all that many bankruptcies. Since then, there have been the big names you know, J. Crew, JCPenney, Lord & Taylor, whole slew of energy companies as well. According to S&P Global Market Intelligence, business bankruptcies are on track to hit a 10-year high before the end of this year. And related?
Consumer confidence is down.
Big decline in consumer spending.
That's a big problem. People are saying, well, maybe I haven't been laid off, but I better save for a rainy day.
And when they stop consuming, the economy decelerates.
You know this, right? It's that whole spending by or on behalf of consumers accounts for 70% of the economy thing that we say all the time.
And so I think the source of concern that I have is that a lot of the economic pain that you'd normally expect to see in a downturn like this has been avoided because of the fiscal stimulus, the CARES Act, and some of the most important provisions of that act have expired.
The $1,200 relief checks, the extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits, the Paycheck Protection Program, all behind us unless and until another package gets through Congress.
And that's going to have economic consequences that may ripple throughout the economy.
Remember, though, that we started talking about history.
The economy has experienced pandemics before.
The one that I know a little bit better and that it resonates with everyone is the 1918 pandemic.
There isn't really good high-frequency data to exactly measure its impact.
The mortality rate was very high.
But I think it's safe to say economically, the impact of the coronavirus pandemic has been much worse.
There are a variety of reasons why. A big one was that the U.S. was involved in World War I at the time.
Which meant lots of demand for goods to support that war and lots of money from the government getting pumped into the economy, even as some businesses had to shut down. So, what's the lesson?
having an expansion of the government that intervenes and tries to minimize the impact of those effects is very important. And in that case, it happened because of the war effort. And right now it's happening through various federal programs.
Various federal programs that have mostly expired.
The more pessimistic lesson that I think I'm learning from this crisis is that the fiscal policy response that's needed in a deep downturn, our political system doesn't really seem capable of producing it.
Americans have a great history of when we want to, of being able to marshal our intelligence and our skills and get it done.
We do seem capable of enacting a response at the time of the greatest emergency. But once the emergency passes, we just don't seem capable of doing what's needed.
At the end of the day here, we have to deal with the virus.
I think we all have our hopes on an excellent medical solution to the crisis, but it doesn't mean that the economy will recover immediately thereafter.
There really isn't a perfect historical reference point for the economic crisis that we find ourselves in. It is actually, as our group was saying, a health crisis. The Great Depression lasted 10 years. The Great Recession was a lot shorter, 18 months, but it took 6 more years after that for all the jobs to come back, and that was without a virus. Thanks again to Kathleen Day at Johns Hopkins, Carola Friedman at Northwestern, and Eric Hilt at Wellesley. We're going to check back in with them again a couple of months down the road. Coming up.
Kind of rough on nights like this where there's nothing happening, but I do love this place.
Businesses are closing their doors, and look, it hurts. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 46 points today, a 10%, closed at 27,739. The NASDAQ added 118 points, 1%, finished at 11,264. The S&P 500 found 10 points, about 0.3%. 33.85. With apologies to Johnny Cash, American Airlines has been everywhere. Man, it's been to Greenville, Huntington, Joplin, Kalamazoo, Lake Charles, New Haven, Roswell, Stillwater, Williamsport, Sioux City. What a pity. Oh, yeah. Anyway, ran out of cities. Now, Americans leaving all those small markets plus 5 more in October after government aid runs out because of low demand, the company says. Investors said nope. Shares in American down 1.4%. Shout out to John Gordon for the Johnny Cash reference. I don't do this show alone, you know, peeps. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look. Payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Republican National Committee reports it raised $55 million in July. That is a new record, which Kind of seems to be the case basically every time we talk about campaign fundraising this cycle. Total political contributions to the presidential race are closing in on $3 billion so far. But a lot of people, especially those coveted small dollar donors, are out of work and struggling right now. So Marketplace's Kimberly Adams took a look at what a recession might mean for political fundraising.
Short answer, not much. At least not when it comes to the race for president.
The conventional wisdom might be that, you know, during a recession, people are going to be less likely to open up their wallets and give to political candidates.
David Primo teaches political science at the University of Rochester.
But what we've seen historically, especially if we look back to the Great Recession, 2008, 2009, is that individuals still were willing to open up their pocketbooks.
And that has a lot to do with just who political donors are. Sheila Krumholtz is executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics.
Money in national politics comes from a very thin layer of very affluent people who give year after year, cycle after cycle.
And who tend not to be seriously affected by recessions. Krumholtz says less than one half of 1% of Americans give more than $200 to political campaigns. Estimates of people who give any amount range from 3 to 10% of Americans.
We saw a great uptick in 2018, and I think we're seeing continued interest in this very intense election cycle in 2020.
And remember, the presidential election isn't the only election coming up. Vincent Hutchings teaches political science at the University of Michigan.
To the extent that other campaigns rely on small donor contributions, obviously Americans are less equipped to make such donations in light of the economic fallout from the pandemic.
Think races for school board, city council, or state legislature, where candidates are much more reliant on smaller donations from people in their own communities. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
At the moment, the story with colleges and the coronavirus is epidemiological, right? How many students have gotten sick and how quickly those schools can shut down. But in the slightly longer run, there is going to be a business model story to tell, too. The small residential college idea worked reasonably well for more than a century in this country. Lately, though, not so much. Even before the pandemic, finances were shaky at hundreds of colleges. Small schools with names you might not know, green quads, brick buildings. A lot of them are closing. APM Reports has been tracking the fallout in a new documentary. It's called COVID on Campus. Here's correspondent Sasha Aslanian.
In early June, when no one could gather in person, hundreds of people came together online for a virtual goodbye.
Of course, as long as there are those of us who can tell the story, McMurray will never really be gone because she lives in our hearts.
It was a ceremony not for a person, but for a college. McMurray College, a liberal arts school with more than 500 students in central Illinois, survived the Civil War, the Great Depression, and two world wars, but it could not survive COVID-19. McMurray was faltering before the pandemic. Enrollment was dropping, costs were rising, and its $15 million endowment was too small to be of much help. McMurray President Beverly Rogers said the college initially had a survival plan that involved borrowing money.
And we found out on a Thursday, that was when COVID had gotten serious and the banks tightened up money, and we found out they were not going to finance it. And on Friday, we announced closure.
Other college leaders worry that their institutions could suffer the same fate. In New York's Finger Lakes region, Wells College officials said they would decide over the summer whether there would be a college for more than 400 students to come back to. President Jonathan Gibraltar said in May that Wells could not get by on remote learning.
If we don't have room and board revenue, we won't have enough revenue to operate the campus next year.
People who study higher education finance have been warning for years that a shakeout was coming for small colleges and universities. Robert Zemsky is a professor at UPenn's Graduate School of Education. He says, think of the flow of college students as a river.
And at the moment, the river is flowing towards big, rich institutions and away from small, under-resourced institutions.
Zemsky and his colleagues estimate that 20% of American colleges, about 200 or more institutions, are on the verge of going under. Among the contributing factors, a kind of financial aid arms race where everybody gets a scholarship.
Every institution essentially thinks if we give away a little bit of money, more students will come to us. So this has been going on for about 15 years. So what you have listed in the institution's catalog is a price almost nobody pays.
Zemsky says at a typical small college, the average student only pays 40 to 45% of the sticker price. Some colleges are trying a tuition reset. That's when a college lowers the price to make it more appealing. It also doesn't have to offer so much financial aid. That's what Wells did. It cut its tuition by 25% to $30,000. And it worked. In early July, the college announced better-than-expected enrollment. That, plus generous donations and a bridge loan, will allow it to reopen and bring students back to campus this fall. The college says it's not out of the woods, and the pandemic brings extra costs, like testing and sanitizing. Sophomore Felicia Jones says the tiny size of the college might be an advantage in battling COVID-19.
The good thing about having small class sizes is you're in a room with 6 people or 10 people. You can be 6 feet apart no matter what.
These small colleges, some with fewer than 1,000 students, offer an intimate college experience, but a business model that's endangered. I'm Sasha Eslanian for Marketplace.
Our story was produced with reporting from Stephen Smith. Let me do a quick call back here to something our economic historians touched on earlier about a growing number of what had been temporary job losses becoming permanent. One of the 10 people we've been following in our series, The United States of Work, is in that number. Neil Cairns is a bartender at a board game bar in Portland, Oregon called the Game Night Lounge. He got laid off in March temporarily, but after a really, really slow couple of months back in business, the Game Night Lounge is turning out the lights forever. So, on a night in the bar's waning days, we asked Neil to keep an audio diary for us.
So it's 4 o'clock. We open up the bar for the day. All the prep work is done. Cash is in the register, and we are good to go. So now it's just a matter of waiting until we see some customers. Well, it's 5 o'clock. I have just finished mopping the bar and giving all the tables a quick once over with sanitizer. I haven't seen any customers yet. 6:45. I still haven't seen any customers. We're all trying to keep busy here, but at this point there's not really any work left to do, so I am searching for jobs and putting in applications, but no customers just yet. All right, it's about 7:40. At 7:15, we got our first two customers for today. I recommended some local drinks. They're tourists. So I wanted to showcase some of our local spirits and our local beers that we always keep on tap. I recommended a game, taught them how to play it, got them going, and now just waiting for some more customers. Well, it's around 8:30 now. I still have my same two customers here, chilling out, playing a game, and I find myself doing what I've been doing a lot of nights lately, which is just looking around the bar and taking it in and thinking about how much I'm going to miss it here and how much I've loved it here. It's kind of rough on nights like this where there's nothing happening, but I do love this place, and getting to spend the time here is still good, even if it kind of hurts. All right, so it is 9 p.m. now. My two customers have left. Generally, lately, we have not gotten any new customers after 9. Every now and then we'll get some folks who will wander by around 9:30 or so. So I'm going to start breaking the bar down and closing up for the night. If somebody comes in before I'm closed, I'll let them on in to have a drink. And otherwise, that's it for tonight. I'm just printing off our reporting sheet for the night. I'm going to show our total sales and all that. We're at $45 for the night. Everyone is gone. We've done last call. Nobody was here to take advantage of it. So we closed the place up. We did $45 in revenue today with two people working for about 6 hours. So that is tonight. And tomorrow we'll open up and do it all again.
That was Neil Cairns, working just a couple of days more at the Game Night Lounge up in Portland, Oregon. As of the most recent jobs report, by the way, there are 2.5 million fewer jobs in bars and restaurants than there were in this economy back in February. The unemployment rate in that industry is almost 22%. This final note on the way out today, a little bit of ride-sharing brinksmanship here in California. There is a new-ish law out here, AB5 it's called. We've talked about it a bit. It would, among other things, force Uber and Lyft to reclassify their drivers as actual employees, not independent contractors. This morning, though, Lyft said, that's it, we're done, shutting it down at midnight as they had threatened. A couple hours later comes word from a California appeals court that the company can keep operating as is, that is, without reclassifying their drivers while it challenges the law. This is not, I promise you, the last we have heard of this. Here's your moment of economic context for this Thursday, courtesy of the Internal Revenue Service. The IRS said in some data released today, it estimates it's going to process 37.2 million fewer W-2 forms next year than it had been guessing it would back in February, which translates, obviously, the way this paperwork works, into 37 million fewer jobs. Here is the really depressing part, though. That gap between what it had been expecting in the before times and what it's expecting now lasts until 2027, when there will still be almost 16 million fewer W-2s than they'd been figuring before this pandemic. Okay, we're done. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.